And so one of these like film, which I also, it's called something like the Companionship or something like that, is about this young guy that is one of these sanatoria, and he gets, you have to get a person from the outside in order to like go on these visits and like go into society for the weekend with one of these passes. So they paired people, and were kind of people basically that were doing some kind of social services because they had like fucked up, and so they, instead of going to jail, they had to do social services. They would pair them with people. This is what the movie said. I don't know, I was just like, oh wow, a movie about this, that's kind of random. But so there's been some kind of like movement. I also wonder if it's also like, there are more articles. There's also a Vice magazine, like kind of these like 10-minute documentary pieces that they do nowadays about this particular moment of the freakies, and they go back, I think, to Cuba and then interview some people who are still alive. There's like a couple, like very few, but there's a couple people who are still alive.
Yeah, there was a piece, I read that yesterday, a piece in Vice magazine.
Yeah.
2 years ago.
But yeah, I think like the sanatoriums, like these kind of, for what I remember, were like maybe like stopped operating in this way maybe in like 2003 or like beginning of the 2000s. So I don't know if anybody knows or cares, but so Cuba had a very particular way of dealing with HIV crisis, and it was that the moment that these people from Angola came and it started being, am I talking too fast or do you follow? I do, I did talk fast, sorry. Basically people at the moment that HIV started to show up in Cuba, and it was like, both actually, it was interesting because it's always this sort of like, you're unable to set up a clear line. So it was both by these people who were like heroes of the state that were coming back from serving these missions and helping like this liberation movement, and then from the deviants, no? Like the sex, like the homosexuals and these deviant people that were also bringing AIDS and tourists. So they started making basically mandatory testing. So if you were going to the hospital for something, if you were part of like a group, like a risk group, which were basically if you were like perhaps homosexual, or if you were like a drug addict or you used drugs, they will do mandatory testing, which basically they tested like, I think, 14 million people, which is insane. And so if you tested positive, you were like thrown into one of these sanatoriums and you didn't have a choice, as they say. And the thing is that the lives in the sanatoria, and this is why many of these people decided to do this, it's in addition to also giving them some kind of like, they become real pariahs. And like they're like, okay, we're not just being discriminated because we have like for the kind of random reasons, like having long hair, posing this abstract threat to the regime, but we are like these sick people that like have a particular protocol, and then like we are in these places. Because of the nature of HIV, the life that these people had in sanatoriums during this periodo especial was much better in many cases, like in bare bones, like what it means infrastructure, it was like they had food, you had like air conditioning, you had like a pool, like very basic things, but that at the time in Cuba were actually very big deals. And on top of that, they were together and they could do their thing together. Like they could have a band, or they could listen to Metallica, or like whatever, Fall in Love. Anyways, when this came out in the United States, which I think is really interesting when you were talking about like this parallel, it was like hell broke loose about like how are the Cubans like dealing with like, in what inhuman way are the Cubans dealing with the HIV crisis? And of course that in a way, for sure, like there is like, you are constricting people's liberties, like you are like throwing them like, whether they like it or not, into these situations. But what the fuck was doing the United States then? You know what I mean? Like, is there like, can you make a moral judgment on like how these people are like dealing with their crisis when you are dealing with your crisis like this, and it just becomes then this politicized object that they were like tossing back and forth? So that was like a long way to make that point.
No, it's good. And you can see the parallel, you know, of the fear of contamination. I mean, the fact that you have to exclude a number of practices. That is a number of people, because you know, you exclude practices means you exclude people. That's exactly what HIV did. You know, you ban practices, so you ban a number of people and you make groups, you know, instead of practices. That's the first thing that the social forces do, and then you exclude them, you condemn them to invisibility, you put them out, you just shove them out of the landscape. So in both cases, it's you have the same thing. You have this fear that, you know, the simple visibility of such people, such practices, is contaminating again. And, you know, I always quote this incredible sentence from Dr. Strangelove, Dr. Follamour, to which, you know, the asshole who reigns in the United States is many times compared, you know, Jake the Ripper, you know, the general in the film of Stanley Kubrick. So he really, the only thing he fears is that the communists are, you know, are injecting some kind of disease to the beautiful and pure fluids of American. That's exactly what he says in 1953, Dr. Follamour. I don't remember, but anyway, you know, a post-war situation where indeed this idea of contamination, you know, is very, very precisely emitted. So it's communists who are pouring these contaminating fluids, i.e. blood and semen, into the pure fluids of the American heterosexual white bourgeois capitalist men, couples, right?
Now, I would like to address something about that question of toxicity, because I think in the context of an asymmetric war, especially in the anti-colonial moment, and in a lot of countries in the asymmetric wars, colonial wars, they use that strategy of toxicity, in fact, and become a toxic body. Where, for example, in Guinea-Bissau, Cabral mined his own country, you know. It was really impossible after the war to use the soil for agriculture because there were so many mines in the soil. So at some point, those guys who produced that kind of gesture that's coming from the asymmetric war or kind of guerrilla, and they talk about that, exactly that if you think you can win the war, so you create a condition that you can be possessed, just in a connection with the first talk we have, you can be possessed by your enemy. So it's not so suicide. I don't totally agree with that term of suicide. I think it's more to get out of the possession of your enemy. You can win, but you decide to choose the way you can.
It's boycott, like you're going to.
Yeah, you get out to put a kind of possibility of the possession, and you get out of the process. But what is really weird in that case is that finally Cuba itself used that strategy against America. So a so close territory to America used to be a kind of toxic figures, you know, politically. It was possible to have base, you know, with missiles. So they used that, and inside Cuba, that young guys used the same strategy that Cuba used against his enemy. That question of toxicity in politics is an history of anti-colonial struggle, I think. There is a link with that in a certain way.
It is true that Felix Gonzalez Torres, a Cuban guy, said, "I want to be a virus in the institution."
Actually, I just have three kind of fragmented comments. And maybe to start from here, actually for me there was something about we're seeing in the movie a lot of masses of bodies, and we have like two kind of those masses. One which are the rockers, and we see a very fluid and wild crowd, and then we see other images which are, well, imagery which is related to socialism. I come from Slovenia, ex-Yugoslavia, and I will make a link now to this, because I thought that actually it's quite strange. In socialism, in Yugoslav socialism, there was also a very strong rock and rock punk movement in the 80s and 90s, which was not suppressed by the state. Actually, in a certain kind, Tito was kind of considering that young people have to have spaces to leave out something, and that actually this will help the government to stay in power, which I think is an interesting understanding of
rock and roll.
Rock and roll. And well, actually, we don't know exactly if this didn't occur later on to, in a certain way, produce critical masses that overthrown the same regime in a very kind of, let's say, general way. So I think here it's interesting when we think about those bodies which are kind of rebel bodies and which we see in the movies don't want to rebel against a particular system or a power system, oppressions and so on, how actually it's perceived that any kind of conforming in a certain way would be, as it said in the movie, to not go with the ideals that they have. In a certain way, staying marginal would mean the only possibilities is to face death. Because I take this back to Yugoslavia, because what we see in a certain way, that a slight conforming of different marginal communities, which were in opposition to the state government, seeking freedom, because this is the point which socialism at that time didn't allow to a certain measure, so freedom of choice or of speech, talking about this, and also part of what you were saying about how equality or a discrepancy of equality in the gender aspect is shown in the movie, of course, the rock context, but also the social context. And I lost my point. Well, in a certain way, is bound to entering any kind of other system to conforming, so losing actually its position of seeking a kind of freedom. And I thought that this is like, it's very radical position, but I thought it's a very, in a certain way, kind of the only possible, I guess, in that situation. Staying true to one's rebelliousness towards the system, because of course you start to think afterwards, okay, but they could have actually organized and led some kind of different mobilization and so on. What it is, but we know that any kind of mobilization then starts to have compromises.
May I just have a footnote to that? That because I was really struck by the sentence that you're referring to, like you cannot give up your ideals without giving up being the person you are, which is exactly the kind of sentence that you would find 20,000 times in every Cuban street wherever you go. So it's that kind of slogan that makes the ideology of the Cuban government. And I was quite struck in that film that they decided nearly never to show these slogans, and only show once Fidel and official gathering, and all the other images are either people in spaces that they have chosen, most of the time outside spaces, though they're not in spaces of houses.
But you were saying that, you know, he had no choice.
I mean, they went, like, the masses are like a concert that happened a weekend when they were shouting. It's like, so they were allowed outside of the sanatorium for a weekend because it was a baseball game.